Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy. I host the show. Today, I have a really kind of neat guest on. He has written a book called Radical Forgiveness, and it's really something that a lot of people have a very hard time with. So I'm going to bring him on right away. We're going to find out about him. Then I'm going to ask him some questions about his book and how maybe he can help some of you listeners. His name is Colin Tippin. So, Colin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, before we start talking about your book, your latest book, Radical Forgiveness, can you tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what prompted you to start writing to begin with, and then especially this particular book?
Okay. Well, if we go back a little bit, I used to be in England, of course. You probably can tell that. Until 1984, emigrated to America. And I was in the teaching profession at that point and had been teaching at London University for 10 years, and came to America to work with a friend of mine, and slowly got rather interested in the metaphysical arena. Atlanta at that time in 1984 was pretty much buzzing with a lot of metaphysical excitement, and it was a very exciting place to be. And I had no religious background whatsoever, which was probably an advantage for me. And not much in the way of the spiritual background either. I had been sort of interested in Eastern philosophy and was searching a little bit because I'd just come out of my second divorce, and so I was at that point in my life where I was, you know, in some sort of a search, although I didn't really know what it was I was searching for. And so for some reason I got interested in forgiveness, and I'm not really sure why I did, at least at the time I didn't know why, because it was not that I had anything huge to forgive myself. You know, of course, I'd gone through a divorce and so on, but it wasn't anything that I had to really forgive anybody for. It was just one of those things. And so I got interested in a form of forgiveness that was much more metaphysical than we normally think of when we think of forgiveness, which subsequently, of course, became radical forgiveness. But what really developed it was that I became qualified as a clinical hypnotherapist and seemed to be drawing people towards me in my practice who had cancer or were getting over cancer or wanting to prevent it. But mostly it was for people who had gone through chemo and done all that kind of stuff but didn't want to get a recurrence of it and realize that doing the emotional work was a very big part of that protocol, even though it wasn't fashionable at that time. In fact, the medical profession was very much against it even. I mean, they put up huge resistance to that idea that emotional treatment has any effect at all. But anyway, I was drawing to me for hypnotherapy cancer patients, and then we decided, my wife Joanne, decided that we would do cancer retreats in the North Georgia mountains, and we called it the Georgia Cancer Help Program, and our tagline was dedicated to emotional and spiritual healing. And it was then that we discovered, of course, that that there was a direct link, and the research very clearly shows it, a direct link between the tendency to create cancer with an inability to forgive, and a tendency always to repress trauma and repress grief and all the negative emotions, or so-called negative emotions, that they have that tendency to repress them and not express them. And that sooner or later it comes out in a physical disease like cancer. And there was a definite link in the research between those two things. So, of course, what we did then was we said, well, all we have to do is teach them how to forgive. And then what we realized, of course, that conventional forgiveness wasn't going to work because that takes years and years and years, and only special people really can achieve it. So we had to then find a form of forgiveness that was going to be appropriate for these people, and one that was going to be fast, almost instantaneous, and easy to do. It wouldn't need a whole lot of therapy, and it would be a simple step-by-step process. And so that was the birth, really, of radical forgiveness. And that's when I created the worksheet. The worksheet became before the book. And I've created a worksheet to help people get into the forgiveness process. And then as I was writing the instructions on how to do the worksheet, I thought, well, maybe I should write a book. And 15 years later, I did it. No, it wasn't that many. I wrote it in 97. How many is that? 10, maybe?
10.
And we've been doing workshops ever since. And so so the book has actually been out since 1997. It was self-published, and Sounds True picked it up last year, so they've issued it now as one of their front list books, and so they are now my official publisher.
Do you think, Colin, that a lot of people don't know how to forgive because of whatever reason, whether they've never been taught that or they figure that they've got to hold on to it so it doesn't happen again and it's a way of protecting themselves?
Well, all of the above, but I mean, really, the truth of the matter is that there never was a system of forgiving. People would always say, you know, you should forgive, you should let bygones be bygones, you should let go of the anger and resentment, but no one had a system. No one could tell you how to do it, and it was almost impossible to do for the very reasons that you just elucidated there. People didn't know how to let go of a story, and if you're deeply victimized, and you hang on to the idea that you're a victim, then forgiveness is absolutely impossible. And so conventional forgiveness, even though it was well-meaning, really didn't give anybody a way to do it, because it supported both the idea that you still have the right to condemn the person for doing what they did, even though you're going to try to forgive them. And that's a recipe for gridlock, and so that wasn't going to work. It certainly wasn't going to work for our cancer patients. So that's why I developed the radical forgiveness system, which is quite different from conventional forgiveness. Well, it's similar to start with, but it makes a big jump beyond conventional forgiveness once we get into the process.
Now, you talked a little bit about a worksheet as a start. How does the worksheet work? You know, what is it? What do they have to do with it?
You know, when I first created a worksheet, and it takes you through telling the story and then feeling the feelings, and then slowly sort of gets you to a point where you reframe the story in terms of a spiritual interpretation of what happened. The idea being, of course, I should explain really what radical forgiveness is, otherwise the worksheet doesn't have any meaning. Radical forgiveness, really, it does everything that conventional forgiveness does, in that it asks you to say what happened and then asks you also to bring some sort of understanding or empathy or compassion to the situation for the person who did what they did, to see if you can pull in some merciful thinking on their behalf for them and so on. But it's still holds on to the idea that the bad thing happened. So that's clear. And that's as far as it can go. With radical forgiveness, however, we take it one step further. And what we say there is that everything happens for a reason. There are no accidents. Everything that happens to us actually happens for us, because it's all part of a divine plan that we had a hand in creating before we incarnated into this life experience, and that we enroll people during our lifetime to give us certain experiences that we actually want in order for our soul to complete its purpose for its journey. So that's a huge step beyond the conventional forgiveness, but it releases us from victimhood. So going back to the worksheet, the steps in the worksheet take us through to that point where all we have to do is to be willing to be open to the possibility that everything happens for a reason, and that this was all part of a divine plan. It only requires a degree of willingness. It doesn't require belief. In fact, the more skeptical you are, the better it works in a way, because it doesn't work through the intellect. It works through one's spiritual intelligence, not mental intelligence or even emotional intelligence, but spiritual intelligence. And this is the part of us that knows who we are, why we're here. It's the intelligence of the soul, if you like. So that's what the worksheet actually activates our spiritual intelligence for us. That's what it does.
Now, you also do timelines. Why is it important to do timelines?
Well, you know, a timeline is a helpful piece of little research that you can do when you put down on the timeline all the things that have ever happened to you in the past, you almost invariably find there's a pattern, which seems to indicate that you're repeating some lesson over and over and over until such time as you actually get it. So if you find that you've been abandoned a lot, then your lesson in this lifetime was probably to experience abandonment. And so it's sort of helpful, and it's verification that something beyond chance and randomness is actually happening in your life, and that you are actually creating these circumstances.
Do you think, Colin, a lot of people have a very hard time taking that responsibility of, you know, knowing somewhere at some point in time or whatever, you know, it may be that they decided to do this?
Not really. You know, what I find is that people are skeptical, and they've got every right to be. I'm skeptical, too, about it. That's why I always say I have no strong belief system around this. I think I make assumptions that this is how things are. But all I know is that in 12 years that we've been doing this work, I see such transformation in people when they open up to that possibility. And I think even when you get a bunch of people who you wouldn't think would be open to it, when you explain it in these terms and give them the opportunity to look at the whole thing and then look at their own life, it's like, yeah, they remain skeptical, but there's a part of them that says, yes, this makes sense. It resonates with me. And so I've actually have found very increasing willingness to accept the possibility that this might be true.
Okay. Now, you just also said assumptions. Now, mm-hmm. A lot of people have different kinds of assumptions, or they maybe not want to know the assumptions, but they're still there. So some of the assumptions that you have listed in your book are actually quite good. Out of those assumptions, which one do you think is probably the most detrimental?
Detrimental to whom?
To the person who's going to go through the radical healing, the radical forgiveness.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by detrimental. You know, the assumptions that are simply there to support the basic concepts of radical forgiveness. I don't know what you mean by detrimental to.
Well, some people, again, Colin, they have a very hard time, you know, thinking that something.
Do you mean difficult to accept?
Difficult to accept, or, you know, where they don't want to accept it at all, let's put it that way, because they just, even though their soul may know it's true, their mental part is going to just fight it.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't think any one of those assumptions is more likely to create resistance than another. In fact, all of them will create resistance in the mentality, in the mind. The mind says it's all crazy to play around in this set of ideas. It makes no sense at all, because that's not how we have conceived of reality in the past. And so it will resist. But the radical forgiveness process, what I always say, is a fake it till you make it proposition. You go through the process and you fill in the worksheets as if you did believe it. And if we do that, that's expressing a willingness to at least try it and see whether anything happens. And 9 times out of 10, something dramatic happens with people when they do that. Now, if they just won't do anything, they won't do a worksheet or anything, they're not ready for it. They haven't gotten to the point in their spiritual evolution where they're ready for it, and that's perfectly fine. So if anybody is that resistance, has that much resistance, I just know that they're not ready. They haven't done what they came in to do yet and haven't experienced enough of the separation that they signed up for, if you like. And so I just say, fine, you know, One day you might. If you don't, that's fine too. So I don't have any problem with people who resist it, because I know that they're on their spiritual path just like everybody else. Nobody's not on a spiritual path. And we only can resonate with these ideas if we're ready to, if we're at the point in our spiritual evolution where it seems to make sense to us. And if it doesn't, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with that.
Also in your book, you have the traditional forgiveness and the radical forgiveness, and you kind of like spell it out, you know, where they verse each other.
Uh-huh.
You know, which is very good because, you know, as I read it, it's like, yeah, it does make a lot of sense, because most people, until they hear about what you offer or what you're teaching or how you're helping them, they only know how to do traditional forgiveness, which really doesn't work down the line anyway. Because
right, and there's no method.
You know, so using the radical forgiveness, because you have a radical forgiveness therapy that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So can you explain a little bit about how that helps people to get to where they need to be?
Yeah, I mean, the therapy really is self-help. I mean, we don't do therapy like psychotherapy where we're trying to change somebody. What we're trying to do in radical forgiveness therapy is for them to open up to seeing what has happened differently, and to let go of the need to feel a victim, and to actually take responsibility for having created the life that they're creating, so that they're then empowered to make the choice to make it differently. That's the thing. But there are what we call the medical model of therapy is, and of course both the therapist and the patient has this in their mind, three questions. What's wrong with you? How did you get that way? And how can I fix you? That's what we call the medical model. In other words, we're seeing somebody as a deficit system, there's something wrong with them. With radical forgiveness therapy, or coaching is really what I call it more than I do a therapy, we ask different questions in our own mind when the person comes into the room, because they may not be ready for radical forgiveness yet. But I'm sitting there as the coach, or the therapist, if you like. I'm thinking to myself, what's perfect about what's occurring for this person? And the second question is, how is the perfection revealing itself? And the third question is, how can I get the person to see the perfection? So it's a very different orientation on the part of the therapist, or coach rather, and the job is to bring the client to see it from the point of view of those three questions, so that they get to understand that nothing wrong actually ever happened and there's nothing to forgive.
Which, again, I think is very important, because most people don't understand that, and they've not been helped with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you also talk about the ego in people, how it can be both an enemy and a loving guide. But
right,
you have to start with it as an enemy first. Is that kind of how I understand your book?
No, in the first edition of the book, I took the idea that the enemy, that the ego is something that we have to resist or disintegrate or fight against, because it's the one that keeps us out of our awareness of who we really are, which is the basic idea, of course, in miracles and many other spiritual disciplines. But I was never comfortable with that idea, because if everything's perfect, how can there be something that isn't perfect in that model? And the ego was always set up to be something that was undesirable. So the way I see it now, I prefer the other one. I prefer the other idea of what the ego is, which is part of one's own higher self. And that's the part of ourself that gives us the human experience. Because we've come here to be human beings with egos. That's the whole point of being here. And to fight against that really is counterproductive. The most spiritual people on the planet, in my opinion, are the people who are most human, but with awareness of their spirituality. That's a wholly different orientation than the idea that we have to struggle against this part of us, ourselves, called the ego. My sense of it is we have to accept the ego and love it just the way it is, and know what its job is, which is to take us through the human experience and to set up situations for us where we will experience the things that we signed up for before we actually came in. So I leave the two definitions in the book so that people can choose which one they want to hang on to. It's whatever you want to believe. There's a very strong attachment to the idea that the ego has to be fought against and disintegrated, and so I left that in there as one possibility, but I put the other one in there as another way of looking at it.
I think it's important that both are in there, you know, so people can try to understand. I mean, because if they're only, you know, basing on one way, what they have learned one time, and they keep with that, they're not going to get very far.
Right.
You know, so they're going to have to kind of get out of their own way, I call it, and look at some other alternatives out there or embrace what they have, not necessarily what they think they know, because
mm-hmm.
it's actually very much different. Now, you also talk about the hideouts and the scapegoats that people tend to use, and you use repression as one of them, and you use projection as another one.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to the repression part, how do people help get themselves out of that?
Well, first of all, repression is a natural defense mechanism which does help us to deal with life. When things happen that are very traumatic to us and that have the potential to overwhelm us emotionally, then denial and repression is a defense mechanism so that we can cope with the situation. I'm sure that there's a lot of people right now in Chile and Haiti going through the experience of the earthquakes who will have very little recall of the actual moment when their house came down, because that would be so overwhelming to them that the only defense they can have, at least in the short term, is to repress the feelings about what happened or even repress the memory of actually what happened. But the problem comes when we use it long term as a way of avoiding the experience itself. So repression really should only be a short term, and that's how most of us use it all the time. We go into denial. Let's say, you know, we suddenly get a telegram that your mother has died. The first thing you say is, I don't believe it. It can't happen. It could not have happened. This is not true. That's our way of coping. But repression, when it is becomes a permanent thing, then becomes an energy block in the body, if you like. And that can set up a pattern where you keep recreating that circumstance in different form, albeit, but it's the same energy. And so that takes us back to the timeline idea, whereas when you plot it on the timeline, you can see how you might have been doing that, and when you see the pattern, then you can say, well, there's something there that I've repressed, and that these people who are doing these things to me are actually doing it for me, so I can bring that to the surface and release the energy. So it's a form of the forgiveness, because once you see that, then you give thanks to the person who has recreated that circumstance. Let's say it's a severe rejection or something, or an abandonment, and that you keep getting abandoned. Well, each time that person does it for you, it's a way to wake you up to the fact that you've got an energy block that needs releasing. And you can bring it to the surface and let it go, and you give thanks to the person for giving you that opportunity, and it's a healing.
It's good, Colin. You keep talking about, you know, forgiving the person who created it. A lot of people today have a very hard time forgiving anything, you know, starting from childhood. And I know that, you know, part of your book talks about childhood. It talks about the guilt that starts way back in the childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And people will hold on to that, in my opinion, because either they don't know any better or because they do know what it is, and because they know what it is, they know what to expect. So that would keep, you know, like redoing and rebringing the same type scenario to them time after time. You know, so I think it's very important that people learn how not to do that. You know, if they want to get out of their own way and let go so they can actually heal. Because until people let go, there's no healing going on.
Exactly. But, you know, when people say let go, what does that mean? I mean, there's no system to help people. I mean, just doing a Dr. Phil and screaming at somebody, let it go, doesn't do anything, doesn't heal anything. The person has got to come to some realization that there was a divine purpose in that situation. And once we realize that, or once we become open to it, the energy goes automatically. That's why anybody can do radical forgiveness, and hardly anybody can do conventional. It's such a simple system, and yet it just requires somebody to be willing to be open to the possibility that there's a perfection in this situation that they won't understand, by the way. We don't know the mind of God or Spirit, but if we just imagine that Spirit knows exactly what it's doing, and the divine plan is all part of that wisdom, then life becomes much more simple, and you can let these things go very, very quickly. You don't need Dr. Phil screaming at you, let it go, let it go.
Screaming doesn't work anyway.
No.
It doesn't work. You know, all it does is make people shut down, and they're not hearing you.
Mm-hmm.
So when I counsel a lot of couples, they say, you know, we argue all the time. It's like, well, why argue? When one person is yelling, why don't the other one whisper? Because when people whisper, the other person shuts up because they're afraid they're going to miss what's being said.
Yeah.
You know, and they look at me kind of funny, like, huh, I never thought of that. It's like, maybe try it. You know, it just might help. You know, that's not necessarily going to be the whole outcome of it, but at least you'll get the other person's attention without all of that hostility going on, because that doesn't work. And you also talk about projections and how people project, you know, upon others. Can you explain that a little bit to the listeners?
Well, again, you know, it's one of those defense mechanisms that comes when we have repressed some shame or real strong guilt about who we are, and a lot of which we learn when we're children. There is always a tendency to want the organism always wants to move towards healing, and so when we're ready to start healing. And it's usually when we've asked for spiritual growth that these kind of things happen. Because once we say, you know, I want to grow spiritually, then our higher self says, ah, good, well, we'll give you plenty of opportunity. But when that moment comes and parts of the shadow start to come up out of the subconscious, then it's very frightening to us. Because then we have to face our own guilt and our own shame, which we've repressed. And so we project it out onto other people. And that's a defense mechanism that everybody uses. We all do it as human beings. And so what we do then is to make other people wrong for the things that we have projected out onto them. And then we pretend, or we fool ourselves into thinking, if we can see it out there, then it's not in here. It's not in me. So it's like having a scapegoat for all our internal shame and self-hatred. But, of course, you know, the spiritual work is to actually come to love our shadow and the parts of us that we have repressed and denied. So so the work, when it comes to radical forgiveness, is to do the worksheet. And on the worksheet, there's a question, or there's a statement that says, I only get upset when someone resonates in me something that I have denied, repressed, and projected out onto that person. And so in that realization, in making that statement, you're recognizing that the person out there who you are judging is actually a mirror for you and is your opportunity to forgive yourself. And that's what it's all about. That's the game, the projection game. Once you realize the mechanism, then every time you meet somebody who upsets you or appears to be unacceptable in some way, is actually serving you by giving you an opportunity to heal that part of you that you've denied and repressed. So in forgiving that person, you forgive yourself.
Again, that forgiveness of self is so very, very important. Do you think that if somebody has a hard time forgiving themselves, that they could actually forgive anybody else?
Well, not really, because first of all, it's one and the same. All forgiveness is self-forgiveness, as I've just explained, because when you're forgiving the other person, you're actually forgiving yourself. And that applies across the board, because if we are all one, then there is no separation. The separation is just an illusion. So when we forgive another person, in the radical sense, I mean, then we're forgiving ourselves at the same time. However, there is some methodology to self-forgiveness that we can separate out and make specific to the idea of forgiving ourselves. And you know, we have self-forgiveness worksheets as well, and a self-forgiveness online program that you can go onto our website, radicalforgiveness.com, and you can sign into this self-forgiveness and self-acceptance program, and go through a very, very comprehensive methodology for using radical self-forgiveness to get to a point where you can love yourself the way you are, not how you think you should be, but the way you are. Which is really the key to self-forgiveness, is recognizing that you are perfect just the way you are, and that's how God made you, or Spirit made you, or how you designed yourself, if you want to see it that way, and that you are the person you are, and you are perfect just the way you are. So it's not that one has to be done before the other, rather that we it's all one, really. It's all one process of forgiving ourselves as we forgive other people, but there are these other things that we can do to get to our shame and self-hatred and get rid of that.
You also talk about, in your book, Radical Forgiveness, the five stages
mm-hmm.
of radical forgiveness. Can you go over those a little bit, please?
Yeah, this is the methodology, really, in all of the tools that we use. You know, with the worksheets, we have a radical forgiveness board game. We have a ceremony that we do. I just did one this afternoon at a church, a wonderful ceremony. We have a CD with the steps on it. Basically, they're questions, like the same questions that are on the worksheet, but you hear me ask the questions, and you simply answer yes to all the questions, whether you want to say no or not. That's not an option. You say yes to all the questions. So the five stages that all of these self-help tools take us through, and the workshops that I give too. So the first of the five stages is telling the story. What actually happened? Who did what? How were you victimized? Or how did you victimize somebody? So that, you know, this victim and perpetrator is no different. The energy is no different. We're all here doing what we're doing. Sometimes we're playing the role of perpetrator, sometimes we're playing the role of victim. So that's the first step. Tell the story. And then, if possible, have it validated and witnessed by somebody else. But if you're doing a worksheet, you're doing that for yourself. The second step, which really arises out of the first, is to feel the feelings. And this is a really important step that a lot of people try to miss out and engage in the repression, suppression strategy. But it's important that we allow ourselves to have the feelings. I really do think that we have been given a physical body in order that in our spiritual journey here on the planet, we get to experience the whole thing through our emotions. And to deny our emotions and to try to avoid them is to actually go against the whole purpose for being here. So feeling the feelings is important, because that's what created the trauma in the first place, of course. Third step is where it gets a little different, and this is where what we call collapsing the story, or collapsing the energy that's holding the story together, which is more accurate. And this is where, even in traditional forgiveness, we do this. We bring our compassion and our understanding and humility to bear on the situation, and we without letting the person off the hook, but we imagine what it must have been like to walk in this person's shoes for a while, so that we can get some understanding. And we also strip away some of the interpretations that we've made about what happened, that has caused us to have all the suffering in addition to the pain. So I define pain as, or emotional pain as, the the feelings that we get when something happens. But suffering is comes about through all the ideas that we attach to the event. And most of what the stories that we have are, in fact, 90% probably suffering and 10% pain because of all the stuff that we've added to the event. You know, if somebody leaves me, then I must be unlovable, or I'll never be able to have a relationship. Everybody leaves me. You know, that's where the suffering comes. Fourth step, however, is the big one, and this is where conventional forgiveness cannot go. And of course, I've already explained this. This is the radical forgiveness reframe, where we accept or be open to the possibility that it all happens for us, not to us, and that there is a divine plan in everything that happens, and that this was all orchestrated by spirit for my benefit, for my soul's growth, and therefore nothing wrong ever happened. So that's the fourth step or stage that we go through. And then the last one is to find a way to integrate it into the physical body in some way. And because the victim story lived in our body, in every cell of our body, so now we want to replace that victim story with the metaphysical story, or the metaphysical interpretation of the story, into the physical body. And we do that if we're using a worksheet through writing. If we're doing the 13-step CD, we just use our voice to give expression to it. If we're doing a ceremony, we're walking across a circle. If we're doing a workshop, we're dancing, or doing breath work. Something physical to integrate it into the body. So the body really gets it, and because the body is the antenna for our spiritual intelligence. We get all our messages from spirit through our body. And so that's an important stage. So those are the five stages.
The law of attraction, that first started, first came out, everybody went crazy with it. And then a lot of people figured out that it wasn't working. Or it wasn't doing what they had expected it to do. And some parts, you know, you tend to agree that it doesn't work, but there's reason. Can you explain maybe to the listeners what those reasons might be that it's not working?
Yeah. Well, first of all, of course, the law of attraction, there's nothing new about it. It's been out there for centuries. Quantum physics has almost proven it to be effective if given certain parameters. But it's not a wish fulfillment scheme as was sort of created by the film The Secret. That's what I think what you're referring to is where everybody went crazy about it and, you know, started to try to manifest cars and bicycles and all sorts of things like that. But the law of attraction is real, and it's based on the idea that our thoughts create reality. And in the 1980s, when I was talking about the metaphysical community was really hot on this kind of stuff. We messed around with the law of attraction by trying to create parking spaces and things like that. And most people were successful at that level, but never took it any further. What was I going to say there? I lost my train of thought. We did the parking spaces deal. Anyway, I've lost that train of thought. But anyway, the reason that we have such difficulty with it, in my opinion, and now this comes out of the other book, of course, the Radical Manifestation book, and the reason that we have so much trouble with it is that most of our energy is not sufficiently in present time. That's number one, to be able to have enough power and intention to create what we want through the law of attraction. It takes energy. It takes focused attention and intention to focus enough of your consciousness on pulling to you those things that you feel that you want. So where is the energy? Well, if you're still full of resentment and anger and you're holding on to victim stories of the past, that's where your energy is. And that's why you're unhealthy, and that's why your energy is low. That's why you can't create your future. That's why you can't create a decent relationship, because all your energy is invested in the stories that you have in your timeline, so to speak, in your memory bank, of all the things that have happened to you in the past that you haven't yet let go of or released. And that's where your energy is invested. And the more repressed they are, the worse, the more energy it takes. And the analogy that I use here is the beach ball. If you take a beach ball and go into the sea and or in a swimming pool and you try to push it underwater, the deeper you try to push it, the more energy it takes to keep it there. It wants to come up. The same is true of repressed feelings and repressed trauma and ideas and thoughts and shame and so on and so forth. So that's where your energy is, and it's not enough to use to manifest your future. So what I've done is try to use the same technology as I used with radical forgiveness and applied it to radical manifestation. And one more thing about that is that the difficulty that we have with manifestation, or conscious creating as it's sometimes called, is that our subconscious mind is many, many times stronger than our conscious mind. So if there is anything in the subconscious that is going to resist you having more of anything, money, more prosperity, better relationships, or whatever it is that you want to create, if there's something in your subconscious that says, no, you don't deserve that, or that's not good, money is evil, money is corruption, those ideas will override any sort of affirmation or intention that you create in your mind. No matter how good you feel about it, like they say in The Secret, just feel good about it. Well, you're not going to feel good about it because your subconscious mind won't let you. And that's really the block. So I asked myself when we were doing this work, I said, I wonder whether your spiritual intelligence is as much of the key to manifestation as it is to radical forgiveness. And it turns out that it is. So what we do with the Radical Manifestation Worksheet is that we have intentionally bypassed the subconscious mind altogether. Let's leave it alone. Let's not try to reprogram it like so many of these systems tell you to, because your subconscious mind is not really programmable, not very. And certainly it's very resistant to being changed. And so what I say is leave the subconscious mind alone, let it have its ideas, and then let's use our spiritual intelligence. Let's do an end run around the subconscious and use our spiritual intelligence to go directly into the universal sea of potential and go straight there using these worksheets. And it seems to be much more effective than the conventional way of doing things.
A lot of people, Colin, they had a really hard time with the law of attraction because of they made several statements in there about you have chosen the path, you're bringing it to you. And a lot of people's mind went kind of berserk with that one, going, well, I didn't will somebody to die, and I didn't will a little baby to die. And a lot of people's minds went that way instead of, I think, really trying to accept what was being said in that book and in that movie too.
Well, it's a perversion of the truth, that's why. I mean, it just isn't. It just doesn't work that way. It's such a high-powered truth that we create a reality. It's true that we do. But to bring it down to such levels is not true. It's not an indication of how it actually works. We're creating our reality all the time at a spiritual level, and at a level which we don't yet understand, I don't think. And the question arises, you know, why does that person die anyway? And what is death? So, there are huge numbers of questions arising around here. So when people take a very complex and deep idea like the law of attraction, or we create a reality, and then fit it in to their limited view of reality that exists now, then of course it sounds crazy. And it is. And it's nothing less than spiritual abuse if you say to somebody who's just lost a baby or has cancer, that you created that is nothing less than spiritual abuse and should never have never happen. But a person that says that kind of thing, first of all, is not is just, you know, spiritually stupid, to put it bluntly, mm-hmm. to say a thing like that, and cruel to say a thing like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, all these concepts work at different levels, and the law of attraction is no different. We try to fit it into our existing paradigms of reality. Of course, it doesn't make sense.
I read the book and I saw the movie, and I said to myself several times, they're missing a lot of good information on this information that's going to just drive people crazy.
Yeah, but it also did a lot of good, and it opened up people to the idea mm-hmm. that there was this possibility. And for some people, you know, it has worked, and people have learned a lot and put it to good use. But there's an awful lot of people too that didn't get it. But at least it's raised awareness, and so I think it served a very useful function there. And it also it hinted at, I don't know how deeply it went really, but it hinted at the idea that quantum physics does support it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have the coming together of mysticism and science and mathematics to indicate that there is truth in there at some level.
Mm-hmm. And quantum physics is something that a lot of people don't understand, but I think it is probably one of the major factors that as people start to wake up, you know, everybody's worried about 2012 coming in, as people start to wake up, I think quantum physics will be easier to accept or easier to understand and see how important it is and how much it really does work. You know, once we bypass that part of our brain that says, no, that can't happen, that can't be. You know, so I think that's kind of some future stuff that's really going to help wake up even more people. Now, in your book, Radical Forgiveness, you also talk about different techniques, and one of them is the forgiveness, and it's a three-letter word. Can you explain that briefly?
Yeah, this has turned out to be one of the most powerful tools, even though I only give about two or three pages to it in the book, because it's so simple. And in fact, I gave a talk about it this morning at a church about one of the best ways to forgive somebody in the radical form is to write these three letters. And the first letter is what everybody would be able to write who's been victimized. This is where you actually write. And by the way, you never send these letters. There's all sorts of trouble if you were to do that. You write these letters for yourself, and the best thing to do is burn them afterwards. But the first letter is your victim letter, and so you're writing the person and confronting them and say, this is what you did to me, and I hate you for doing it, and blah, 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 blah. And it can be as long as you want to make it. It's a venting letter, really. You're getting out of yourself all of the things that you've been thinking, putting it down on paper, and accusing them of doing what they did without any spiritual overlay at all, or even psychological. You just tell the story as, or write the letter and tell the story as a victim, totally, with no interpretation. The second letter, though, equates to that step that I was talking about earlier, where you write a letter where you don't let the person off the hook, but you at least tell them that you have some empathy for them. You might think, for instance, that a father who incested his daughter was himself a sexually abused child, and that this has come through, and that there's some understanding of why he would be acting that out with his own children because it happened to him, and those kind of things, where you bring some understanding and some empathy and some compassion into the situation and walk in his or her shoes for a little while. That's the second letter. And so, but you're still victim. You're still thinking that something wrong happened, but you're trying to understand it more and be more compassionate. The third letter, though, is where we shift into the radical forgiveness way of thinking or the paradigm. And we write a letter saying, thank you for doing this. I now understand. I now realize that at the soul level, you did this for me, not to me, and I'm grateful for the experience and for your willingness to do this for me at great expense to yourself, probably. So that's the three-letter process. It's similar to the forgiveness worksheet, but it's just in the form of letters, which some people find easier and more satisfying to do because it's more expressive, especially if you like writing.
Mm-hmm. And you made a statement that you don't send them, you burn them. What is the symbolism for burning them?
Well, I don't say you have to burn them, but I think it's a good idea for two levels. Number one, so that no one else reads it, because the last thing you want to do is let it fall into the wrong hands so that somebody who could harm you by it, because you're probably going to put things in this letter that's pretty personal. So that would be the first thing, just safety. But secondly, when you burn something, you're transforming it. And in this sense, when you write these three letters, you're transforming your consciousness from a victim to the more spiritual interpretation. So it's a transformation in and of itself. So you can make the burning of the letters a transformational ritual.
Mm-hmm. You also use them with water, too.
Yeah. There's all sorts of ways that you can create a little ceremony or a little ritual around it to symbolize your transformation. Water is a good one. I mean, or even shredding it. I mean, any way that you can convert it into a different form of energy. And I think burning is the most acceptable form of ritual transformation.
Yeah, I like the burning. I use part of that when I counsel with people, too. Now, we only have probably about 5 or 6 minutes left, but what I'd like for you to do is give out your website again and let people know where they can get your book from.
Okay. First of all, the Radical Forgiveness book can be obtained through any bookstore. It's in all the bookstores, including Barnes & Noble and Borders. But you can also come to our website and buy it there, along with a lot of other CDs and DVDs, training programs, and all sorts of other goodies. And that's at www.radicalforgiveness.com, which is pretty easy to remember, radicalforgiveness.com. You'll find that there's a load of information there, as well as a lot of free stuff. We really believe in free, and we give away a lot of stuff. The worksheets are all free. You can simply download them for nothing. And we've got online worksheets that you can go on and do it, and there's no charge. Just register and go ahead and use it as many times as you like. And, people, we had this up now for almost 10 years, and people just love that thing and use it often. Whenever they get upset about something, they go on and do the forgiveness worksheet online. So lots of free things, lots of free downloads, free reads of the book or parts of the book. And, it's worth going there just to explore and see what's available.
Actually, there's a lot on there because I explored just to make sure. I have one other question for you, and we're probably going to have to make it a little brief. But the breathing work is very important. Can you explain why?
Well, it's another one of that instance where we have to use, in stage number 5, some way of integrating it into the body. And I know no better way than through breath work. And that's, conscious breathing, where we breathe deep into the belly and breathe consciously. The breath somehow, it's the breath of life, I guess. And so when we do conscious breathing in this way, that's when a lot of the integration happens for us at the physical level and the spiritual level. But what we say in the book is don't do this on your own. It's not a good idea to do breath work on your own because you never quite know what, something. You can go quite into an altered state with breath work. And if you're on your own and you're not with somebody who knows how to work with you, it can be a little alarming and a little scary. So we wouldn't recommend that you do breath work on your own.
If people wanted to be able to, you book yourself for lectures and all different kinds of seminars, and not just for personal, but also for corporate and everything else.
Yes.
Would they get in touch with you through your website?
Yeah, that's the best way, I think, to because there's a way to get there through and to email me through the website and make inquiries about anything like that. But we do have a particular corporate website too called QEMsystem, QEMsystem.com. Stands for Quantum Energy Management System. That's a separate website altogether.
Okay, and that's basically for corporate?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And if you were going to go into corporate, and we have about a minute and a half left, if you were going to go into corporate, how, you know, what would be the purpose of doing that?
Well, it's a management technique, and it's also an employee benefit, both together, because what we're really doing there is conflict prevention and conflict resolution using the radical forgiveness process. And it's a pity we don't have a little bit more time to explain how it actually works, but it's certainly going to help a company with its attrition rate to stop people leaving, you know, because basically people leave because they're unhappy. So what we're doing with radical forgiveness is creating a happy workforce, which is automatically a productive workforce. And you know, a high-paid executive is a very expensive proposition to replace. So much better that we work with them and help them come to peace around a particular issue that they might have with a colleague or something like that.
Okay. Can you give out your website one more time before we have to say goodbye?
RadicalForgiveness.com.
Okay, so hopefully a lot of people go. The book was very good. I read the whole thing, and it made a lot of sense to me.
Good.
And I'm sure that it will make a lot of sense to people if they just take the time to read and follow it.
Well, the payoff will be great.
I think so. I mean, like, it's a pretty neat book, and I have to commend you for writing it, because a lot of people got a lot of things out there on the market that I've read. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But, you know, they have it out there. So, you know, this one I would actually tell people it's worth buying, it's worth reading, and it's worth following.
Oh, good.
So
thank you.
You're very welcome. With that, I'd like to thank you for being on the show, taking the time, you know, to discuss your book and tell us a little bit about yourself. I thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. I hope you have a great week. Take care, and we'll talk later. Bye now.